Hello and welcome to the LSE Higher Education Blog Podcast. Higher education today is fraught with a variety of issues surrounding work. Precarious contracts, pay disputes, strikes, and increasingly heavy workloads. I'm Dallas Odell, and today I'm looking at how much time we spend working in academia. I'm a PhD student here at the LSE researching degrowth. Degrowth is the planned downscaling of production and consumption to bring these systems within planetary boundaries while prioritizing well-being over economic prosperity. I have come to feel a bit of a paradox as a researcher on the topic, between the pressure to put my work out there while also wanting to prioritize a less intense, more deliberate way of life in line with degrowth. Work time reduction policies aimed at reducing the hours of paid work in a week are often cited in degrowth literature, which is written by academics. Yet this feels quite disconnected from the compounding pressure on academics to work more and more. I wanted to discuss the topic further with some fellow academics who are at different career stages, so I invited Dr. Emma Garnett, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the Sustainable and Healthy Food Group at the University of Oxford. Joining her is Dr. Fred Basso, who is an associate professor at LSE's Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science. I kicked off by asking Emma and Fred how they would describe their current workload, how much time they spend on work in a week, and what the most challenging aspects of the workload is.
So I work a four-day week, so that's 80% full-time equivalent, and I'd say kind of average between 9:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. If I've done a fewer hours during my Monday to Thursday, I'll make some time up on Friday, or if there are deadlines coming up and stuff like that, some extra hours. I think my workload, I'm quite lucky with the position I'm in. I'm not having to do teaching, which can take up a lot of academics' time. I'm able to focus on research. But the uncertainty over contracts and where the next lot of funding is going to come from means that that does sort of hang over you and influence the work you're doing and, you know, short-term and long-term plans. And I'm very aware that for so many others around me who perhaps do have permanent positions, or maybe even not, but particularly administrative staff, IT, people working on the legal side, are really under-resourced, and the people that are there have a huge workload. So I think that is challenging for the people and the institutions as well.
Thanks, Emma. Fred, how about you?
Yeah, so when it comes to my workload, it's actually not easy to say because it can vary according to the constraints, the duties that I will have. But I will say that because I don't like to sleep, so it's not something that I like doing. So I wake up quite early in the morning. So the first thing I do is to read a bit of the newspapers, get myself updated, but also then to start working on my papers and on my research or reading articles. So I start quite early, and so around, like, depends sometimes. I mean, usually five, but sometimes early on, it depends if I have a lot of work to do, and because I can't sleep anymore anyway. So, and so then it takes, like, I do that for 10 hours usually, and then I stop quite early in the evening, so I don't finish as late as Emma does. So it's around 6 or 7. And I do that 5 days a week. And then during the weekends, I also, because I wake up very early because I don't sleep at weekends either, I read things or work in Saturday and Sunday morning. So usually I do 50 to 60 hours a week when it comes to work. Could be more intense sometimes if you have a lot of marking or things like that during a short window of time. Then I will say that this is not that much painful to me, given that I actually don't consider that reading an article is that much of work. I mean, sometimes I do feel that this is pleasure also, so it's very hard for me to say where the difference is. And what it becomes challenging is to find the boundary between my work and my private life, because it's hard to stop at some point thinking about my research or what I read or a book that I am working on an article or data collection, an article to revise and resubmit, for instance, which sometimes like keeps you very aware and focused. And so this is part of the workload that I find difficult to do, is to find the difference between your private life and your work. So that's what I would say briefly.
Thanks, Fred. Yeah, it's interesting to hear different perspectives from different career stages, but also maybe different positions in life. And I would definitely be curious to know how your workloads compare to sort of your average academic. But anyway, so in the UK, 61 companies entered a four-day workweek trial in 2022. And the project appears to have been rather successful. So 56 of these companies extended the trial indefinitely. To my knowledge, though, there has been no such conversation about reducing work hours for academic staff in higher education of UK institutions. Fred, why do you think that this might be the case?
I thought about it because I think it's an excellent question, because academic staff might be very happy to actually work 4 days a week. I think that actually, if they wanted to, they could. So I went back to the terms and conditions of my work at the LSE, and it's written that we are supposed to work 35 hours a week. And it's not said that it has to be 5 days a week, not that I have noticed. So you could, for instance, do the 35 hours a week within 4 days if you wanted to. But to my knowledge, academics, and this is something that we know from the recent strike and the social movements that we had in academia, academics on average work 50 to 60 hours a week. That's what we observe. That's the tendency. So it's hard to pack 60 hours in 4 days. And I believe that this is because in a sense, what we do is very time consuming, and it's sometimes very hard also to anticipate how long something is gonna be. If you think of data analysis, for instance, when you start analyzing your data, it might take, like, sometimes it goes fast, but sometimes it takes like ages. I recall when I was crunching some fMRI data on a project, it was like dragging forever, and it could be endless, and it extended my work by hours, but also by weeks and months and so on. So I think at the end of the day, the thing is the fact that we cannot really ring fence our work and say, okay, today within 12 hours, I'm going to do that, and I will be done by that day. It is possible at times, but it might be very difficult. And this is where I think academics might be not reluctant, but might find difficult to work to work 4 days a week. I don't say it's impossible. I think it might be difficult.
Well, that's interesting, because I think if academics are working, or if anyone is working 60-hour work weeks and doing that over a prolonged period of time, I think, you know, well-being, like physical and mental health, you know, could suffer. Or also simply, even if it's not, that the quality of work per hour or the amount you're getting done per hour is probably much less than if you have a shorter working week. Because some of the findings from the four-day work week is that there isn't a decrease in productivity. Sometimes it's an increase. And I think if we're thinking about sustainable, equal societies, if you're working a 60-hour week, you know, who's making your meals? Who's cleaning your house? Is that a female partner? Is that an underpaid laborer? That, you know, what are the externalities of having work schedules that are punishing? I think flexibility in working is really beneficial. And so I'm not saying that no one should ever work a 60-hour week. You know, so often when there's a deadline or a crunch period, or, you know, all of your marking, like you said, Fred, then it can be quite satisfying to just really you know, blitz through a huge workload. But I think that for that to be sustainable, that has to be counterbalanced with much fewer hours the next week to avoid burnout, which we know is also a huge problem in many fields, including academia.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And that, to say, for instance, to follow up on what you said, this month I was working on a colleague with a book that I was finishing with him. So we were working starting very early in the morning and having long days. And as soon as I submitted the book, then during the week that followed, I was a bit less working less intensively, because I know that the academic year is starting now. And then I will feel that I can't keep working that much, and I need to restore a bit or my energy. But as I said before, to me, sometimes what we call work is not necessarily, or can I say, like, work? It could be also pleasure, just because reading an article might be relaxing. And if you divide your time in some ways, you can find a relief. Yeah, that's how I would say that. Yes.
If there's time, I'd like to respond to that. I think just because you're enjoying parts of your work doesn't mean that it doesn't count as work and working hours. There's an article from Jacobin back in 2013 talking about the tyranny of do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life, and how difficult that can make it to get a work-life balance. And I think that risks putting a lot of responsibility on individuals to enjoy their work and feel grateful for it when actually you're providing your labor in exchange for a salary. I agree and think things can get quite blurry when you do love parts of your job and it feels like a vocation, and it can and does blur into your personal life and time off. But there are plenty of people who don't love their jobs or who are employed in jobs that are on average people find less enjoyable, which is still really important and still need doing by someone. And I think, and of course, we should advocate for better working conditions for everyone. And that might make jobs more enjoyable for many. But I think just because academics or anyone enjoys aspects of their work doesn't mean it shouldn't be considered part of your total work hours. I think that's a very dangerous path.
Thanks, Emma. And thanks, Fred. That's definitely interesting and different perspectives. And we will come back to, I think, this topic a bit more. But before we do so, I'm curious, Emma. So you have had some experience recently. You say you work a 4-day work week, which is pretty atypical amongst academics. And there are, you know, work time reductions that people take for a variety of different reasons, might be in relation to degrowth. It might have no idea or awareness of the term degrowth. So I'm curious, in your case, what was your motivation for reducing your work time? And what has been your experience so far?
Well, the postdoc I applied for after my PhD, on the application form, there were options for an 80% full-time equivalent or 100%. And I thought, oh, that's great. I'll go for the 80%, and I'd like to do that over a 4-day work week. And I was supported in doing that. Someone in the organization did say, well, why do you want to work a 4-day week? And I thought, well, why don't you want to work a 6-day week? That just seemed a very, the kind of 5-day normality, the norm has become very, very ingrained. This first job I began in September 2020. So the kind of lockdown and that part of the COVID pandemic, which is ongoing, but the lockdowns were, arriving and leaving and arriving and leaving, especially in the UK. So I think it was quite an odd start to a 4-day work week, but my motivations were to have more time, essentially, and to work better when I was working, not just have the sort of presenteeism of just because you state that you're working or you're at the office or at your desk doesn't mean you're necessarily being productive. And so that was more time, for sleep and hobbies and visiting friends and family and relaxation, but also more time for what I'd call like unpaid labor. And I think that can run the spectrum from, cooking, which is something I enjoy doing, to, cleaning my house, which is something I don't enjoy doing, but also environmental and political activism. And I think that speaks to Fred's points about, when you're working on sustainability, the blurred boundaries between what is your kind of day job and what, when you're stepping outside of that, but still very related, does get quite thorny. And I don't want to overstate the activism that I do, but I do spend time doing environmental and political campaigning, and I think that is often I'd call that a little bit more unpaid labor than a hobby. I wish the climate and biodiversity and inequality crises were solved and I could be relaxing with friends rather than marching in London on a cold or too hot day, but we're not there yet. And so someone has to say we need things to change. And many, many people do. And so I think that just having a bit more time to do these non-paid labor activities, which I think are really important. And I think those were important regardless. But for academics who are thinking about a 4-day working week and a bit worried that they'll have less productivity, I think my involvement on the law activism side has also informed and benefited my research. It means I found out things which meant I've ended up on papers I wouldn't have done otherwise. It's given me insights into new topics. So I think purely from a productivity point of view, you can say, doing things with your time other than work could help your academic career, which for some people might sound a bit counterintuitive, but it gives you a chance to step off the treadmill, take a look around, and come back on with a bit more energy.
Awesome. Thank you. So my main motivation for this whole discussion, which is somewhat relevant to the talk we were having before, is thinking about sustainability, degrowth, well-being researchers, how they should be the best informed about the benefits of working less, including reducing emissions, but also improving health and well-being. They might have even published pieces promoting work time reductions. And, some academics even oversaw the UK 4-day work week trial. And yet, as individuals, academics tend to push themselves to work harder and harder to get papers out there, to win more grants, to achieve more accolades. So there feels like this is a very large disconnect from the sort of cognitive knowledge of the benefits versus the personal experience in how you behave. So Emma, do you think that academics consider themselves exempt from these benefits of working less? Or do you think that there is maybe the sense of urgency or the sort of activism role as well from the climate crisis that makes their work feel more pressing or more timely or in need to work more?
Well, I think there's a whole thesis in that question. These are really important points. Let me see if I can go through these in some semblance of order. I think everyone can struggle to practice what they preach. I think that is also true within academia. In terms of the, you know, have to work really hard because of what I'm working on is so important. I think research is important and it is, you know, often very enjoyable, why academic jobs are so competitive. At the same time, I think looking at the climate and biodiversity crises, these are not going to be solved by one more paper. We are not stopping from acting due to a lack of information. We are swimming in information about climate and biodiversity loss. What we need are policy changes. And one of the ways we get those policy changes is through activism. You can't, it is very difficult to get employed as an activist more so than academic. I think this is the real stopgap on action. And so for academics who are feeling that, this is so urgent, I can't stop working, I would say, well, you know, maybe work a bit less in your, you know, office and on your papers and, you know, go out and, you know, start marching, start protesting, start lobbying for actions to be taken, get involved with, you know, local, national elections, try and change the needle. We know that this can work and it's the only way it works. I think the data underpinning that is important, but you kind of use that privilege of getting paid to do research to also go and advocate because you were very well informed. So I think that is really key. I think some academics perhaps we can consider ourselves slightly separate from the society that we're trying to, you know, change or advocate. I know, you know, one conservation academic, when I was saying, well, we should be campaigning and, you know, lobbying for action on biodiversity, he was like, oh, but we already work on it, so surely that's for other people to do. And I just completely disagreed with that, and I thought, no, this is our passion, we're getting paid for this, we're very well informed, it's up to us. You know, because is he lobbying and advocating for policies about homelessness or, you know, female reproductive health or all these other super, super important issues, which he's not working on, but other people are? I think if we want people to also take part in our kind of, I don't want to quite say special interest, but if we want people who don't work in sustainability to join in the campaign for change, we should also join in other campaigns across environmental and social justice. So I think in terms of the urgency of it, I think we can't afford not to devote some time away from work and towards campaigns.
Thank you so much. And Fred, what sort of interventions do you think could be put in place? So at what level of the academic institution do you think interventions need to be made for academics to work less? So you said maybe that they could, but what do you think really would need to change?
That's a good question. I think it's it will depend on which academic you ask to. For instance, if I imagine that some of my colleagues, they might say, oh, we should have less teaching or less marking or less supervision, for instance, and might free up some time. I'm not sure about that, because I think it matters a lot also to pass on the knowledge. And part of my activism, quotation mark, is also through education, I believe, because this is what can make a change by educating the generations and not to think the next generations and not to think that it's just with short-term interventions that something my workout that we need. It's really like a mindset. It's really a worldview that we need to share with people. If speaking of worldview and mindset, I think that one thing that we could change institutionally is the whole policy, or can I say industry policy or education policy that is revolving around research, which is, for instance, to always be focused on impact, to always be focused on grants and so on. And academics play a lot of part in there. I mean, there is a kind of, if you use Marx, a term, for instance, form of a false consciousness, you know, or some form of governmentality, if you take Foucault, just that people tend to embody at some point, to incorporate the way of thinking that is in their environment, and they justify the entire system. And I see some colleagues who are very much into sustainability or even degrowth, and that starts commoditizing themselves as we do commoditize research, commodify research with where papers become a commodity, where you are a researcher who is looking for funding. So then you get the funding and you are a manager, you're managing people and your ideas have been sold to someone. And then you have also your advertising, your research could be on LinkedIn, could be on your website. And so there is like a kind of trend that is created around that, and that then it becomes very difficult to escape the obsession with publication and being more productive. Because if you do have a website where you advertise yourself, if you have nothing to advertise after a few months, then it looks like you don't have activity anymore, you see. So there is this mindset that you need to grow because you are showcasing yourself and advertising yourself. So I think that to some extent, this is part of what we can change. Like this focus on the individual when it comes to research, the starification that we can observe at times with research, and think more about long-term perspective and something that is like, okay, well, I might not do anything for 2 years in terms of publications, but I'm working on a big project that I believe could make sense when it comes to this kind of research in sustainability or whatever.
Yeah, I think you touched on a lot of very important points. One of them definitely being these sort of the idea of reproducing these institutional norms of productivity, even within spaces like degrowth research, which leads very well to my next question, which is about how in the past few years, so the field of degrowth research has obviously proliferated substantially. A recent review suggests that from 2014 to 2020, the literature grew by 5 times, and it has continued this acceleration since then. And, you know, even talking about pieces related to reducing work time, that has also proliferated in this time period. So this heightened sense of productivity is obviously not the most degrowth approach to academic research. And it does appear to contradict the downscaling objective of degrowth, at least superficially. Now, there could be more of a discussion about whether or not that is the case, but at least I would say on the surface it does. So Fred, as an academic who works on degrowth related research, how do you feel about this vast increase in interest and publications on the topic? And do you feel the pressure to keep up?
That's an important question. And indeed, it's a paradox. So on one side, I would say this is very positive because I think that it's an important topic. And so that degrowth is one way of, I mean, to question things and to look differently at sustainability by questioning the roots of the economic system and the obsession that we have with growth and some of the very Western-centric ideas that we have about what the world should be, and that growth is good for the sake of growing and so on. On the other side, I would like to see whether the fact that it has been multiplied by five in a few years stands only for degrowth or more generally for sustainability. Because perhaps relatively to sustainability, actually, there is more interest in degrowth, but not that much more than what is happening to sustainability, and especially the alternative model, which is green growth. So perhaps there is more interest in green growth in absolute terms, but by comparison with green growth, it's not the case. Just to add to what you mentioned about, do I feel the pressure to keep up? Not that much, actually, because I'm not working only on degrowth. So sometimes my attention shifts to something else. I was working on embodiment beforehand, like for a few months, not that much on degrowth. But one thing is that where I will feel, the kind of feelings I will have is overwhelming, because then when I go back to the literature, I come across like 100 more papers on something, and then I don't know what I should say, you know, so which questions the thing of, okay, should I focus only on one a part of research, or should I try to encompass several things, which is a big problem that we could have also in research at some point when we have to choose our topic.
I think another reason degrowth research is it's important to find a balance between doing timely work and maintaining values is for gender equality. And one of the things I think degrowth talks about is, you know, the value of unpaid labor, like, and how much is done by women. And you know, Dallas, you know, you've said not many academics work part-time, but lots of mums work part-time. And indeed, my line manager, she is a parent and she also works a 4-day week. So I think if you're wanting to have gender equality within academia and within degrowth research as well, if you're not allowing and making space for people who are working part-time, like both for, you know, fathers and mothers, but particularly how much that kind of impacts women. I think that's really key. And we know that in terms of the leaky pipe syndrome, which means you have fewer and fewer women in academia, the higher up you go, that's what the leaky pipe refers to. And that there is a particular drop off after the first postdoc, which is, you know, late 20s, early 30s, when many people are starting families. So I think that is so key as well.
It's a great point. And yeah, I think it kind of relates maybe to this idea of slow science as well. So opening up possibilities for different and slower working styles that might actually benefit our research and our lives at the same time. So this idea of slow science prioritizes a slower and more thoughtful type of research practice than I think most academics face today. And the book, The Slow Professor, sort of goes into a bit more detail about this idea. Fred, I'm curious what your thoughts are on slow science and how you think that sustainability researchers could integrate these practices into their work, despite this sort of pressing need to do more work for the climate crisis.
I have to confess that I haven't read the book. I have read a review of the book, and I think it's a very interesting perspective, and I might read the book. There is a whole slow movement that grew quotation marks in the late in the past decade or so, and it's a key thing, I think, to some extent, to try to find out some more authenticity in things also by slowing down, thinking about what is important, what is key, stopping being focused on accumulation. One thing that you mentioned, and that is intrinsically within your question, is the fact that, okay, but if we slow down the research on degrowth or sustainability, what's going to happen when it comes to tackling climate catastrophe and global warming? I have to say that in my opinion, we should not overemphasize the role of researchers. I have to say they are important, of course, but to help understand, to document, to inform, to explain, to educate, and so on. But the changes are not going to come from researchers. I think they are, partly, but degrowth is a democratic movement. It's an activist movement also, and sustainability is something that should be democratic. And we should not lean towards some form of technocratic solution where we believe, oh, we will have a lot of scientific solutions and we are going to apply them and we are going to sort out the problem. No, that's a collective discussion that everyone should have. And the change and the way we can tackle global warming should come from collective discussions. So if we slow down, for instance, publish less on sustainability, but actually, as Emma suggested, we become more active in what we do in the public sphere, in the democracy, in the public debate. Well, perhaps that might help tackle the problem of global warming than just publishing papers that no one is going to read apart from a community who already believes that actually, yeah, there is a problem and we need to do something, you know, because you are just preaching to people who think like you. So I would say, like, yeah, to some extent, we might see some very good sides with the slow professor perspective. And by the way, within this movement, there is also a connection to education, the importance of transmitting values and ideas and working with the students in a way that is more progressive, not just to spoon feed information and so on. And so I think that's part of the general mindset that should be adopted by academics. At least that's the one I try to have.
I think it's really interesting to think about. Yeah. So degrowth talks about not just less of everything, but potentially more of social and ecologically just jobs, more access to those sorts of jobs. And it is interesting to think about whether academia or the role of an academic fits into that, or sort of what aspects. So maybe education being more important to emphasize than research working in the future. But so maybe let's imagine a world in which academia does start to adopt work time reductions. Obviously, working less, if you look at the literature, is not necessarily a silver bullet when it comes to emissions reductions. And there could actually be a sort of rebound effect of increasing emissions if people spend their free time consuming more. So for example, if they cook or eat more meat heavy dishes, or if they do more long haul traveling. Emma, given your work around behavior change toward more sustainable diets, what do you think is needed to prevent academics from actually consuming more if they do work less? And how do you think behavior would change?
That is a really important challenge. And of course, if people start taking a 4-day week and are using that third day, that 3-day weekend to take budget flights to other cities, you know, in other countries or domestically that they wouldn't do with a 2-day weekend, that would lead to much higher carbon emissions. So exactly as you say, we can't assume it's a silver bullet, but I think the policies we need to decarbonize and conserve biodiversity and our environment are pretty similar, like regardless of if we've got a 4-day week as default or a 5-day work week. We need, you know, high quality, frequent and accessible public transport. We need carbon taxes. We need investment in public goods and massive reductions in inequality. So that holds regardless. I think speaking personally, but as someone who's very conscious of their carbon footprint, I think having a 4-day week, the way you use your annual leave is different. And I think it can make people more prepared to travel by train rather than plane because you've got more time in the bank and you don't feel like you're burning through your annual leave so much. And indeed, some organizations give employees some extra days off if they're traveling by train instead of plane, which I think is a brilliant idea and should be rolled out very widely. And I think because I've got that third day, which is generally on a Friday, but my line manager is great and I can move that sometimes to a Monday or another day as need be, this means I'm not having to use up my annual leave for a long weekend. I came back from, you know, a 3-day festival last weekend. I didn't have to take extra annual leave for that. And if I needed, instead, I don't need to take time off to do various administrative tasks or run errands, I can do that in that extra time. And that means that my annual leave budget, I can have kind of exclusively for, you know, quote unquote, proper holidays or longer weeks. Another friend of mine who's worked a 4-day week in the past, she had her day off on Wednesday. So she only had to work 2 days a week, 2 days in a row. Let me start that again. A friend of mine who worked a 4-day week in the past, she's a full-time parent now, had her day off on Wednesday. So she never had to work 2 days in a row, and that suited her best. And that meant on that Wednesday, she could rest, you know, do some chores. And then that left the 2 days, Saturday and Sunday at the weekend, for more, you know, family time, friend time, getting up to things. And so I think that has been one of the big changes for me, just having that flexibility, not having to spend your annual leave on smaller things, quote unquote.
Great. So it sounds a bit like some personal mindset shifts, behavior shifts, but also some policy level implementation of allowing for maybe a different usage of your time and incentivizing those sorts of programs. Great. Thank you so much for those thoughts. So I guess I'll wrap up with the last question. I'm curious, we've used the word degrowth a fair bit today, personal bias perhaps based on my research, but it has been called the missile word, and the word degrowth often evokes a very strong and potentially negative reaction from a variety of people on both sides of the aisle. And though I do think it's important to connect the dots across behaviors and values that may be aligned with degrowth and the related movement, but maybe not using the word. So do either of you have any final thoughts about how to engage listeners who may be a bit turned off by the word degrowth or their perceptions of the movement, but may connect to the idea of working less, both inside and outside of academia, and other ways of protecting the environment or having a sort of simplified life?
I think when some people, when they hear the term degrowth, can worry about recessions and that economic uncertainty and job losses and possibly, you know, lower standards of living. However, gross domestic product, GDP, that's how we measure growth, and it's not a good metric for well-being. And instead, if we're focusing on how can we have a healthy society where everyone has their needs met, sort of physical, mental, etc., I think a lot of people could get behind that. And I think the idea of not just running in a rat race and having time for the things that matter does chime with a lot of people. There's a 2012 Guardian article from a palliative care nurse about the top 5 regrets of people who are dying, which is very interesting. You can find it with some Googling. And the second one listed is, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. And just knowing that so many people regret that and that we could set up a system differently, I hope would chime with many people.
Great. Thank you. Fred, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Emma said is very important, and it's very meaningful. I believe that if you are thinking of the word degrowth, it's true that it's shocking, but to some extent, I mean, isn't it the purpose of some activist research at some point, like to create like a form of awareness for people to be shocked? It means that, oh, wow, it's challenging something that we were taking for granted, that growth is good and that perhaps actually we might discuss that and it's not always good. We equate, especially in Western societies, economic growth with progress, but I'm not sure. There are many things that are about progress that came from social movements, right? I mean, I don't recall that it's economic growth that gave people, holidays, for instance. You had to fight for this. I mean, previous generations. So it's something about degrowth that I believe is important in the wording. The fact that for people it might be difficult to adopt perhaps words like sufficiency or minimalism, or you have also some alternative views. So for instance, recently some colleagues in ecological economics, they suggested the word well-being economy. You have also a whole movement that comes from what we call the global south, that is climate justice, which is a bit different from degrowth, but you have some overlap. So there are plenty of ways we can approach these alternative ways of thinking. In a sense, the point is always the same. It's going back to a community and something that is meaningful to people, where social relations are more valued than economic growth. And that's, I believe, what is essential and that you can find across these several movements that I mentioned. So, yeah, wait and see where it goes. But I think they do a great work with the word degrowth at the end of the day.
Thank you. Well, yes, whether or not you like the word, hopefully the ideas do resonate. And thank you both for your thoughts. And thank you just generally for joining me today. This was really a great discussion. I hope you enjoyed it as well. This is a topic that has definitely been weighing on my mind for the past few years as I've navigated through my PhD. And I think it's just really essential that we have these discussions and start breaking down these unhealthy norms in our academic culture and sort of think about other ways that we can spend our time, maybe not more productively, but for better use and for our own well-being as well. So thanks again. And if you are still listening and you have any thoughts about what you heard today, please do leave a comment below or share some ideas. We would love to hear what you have to say. But otherwise, if there are no other closing thoughts, I'll just leave it there. And thank you so much for joining, Fred and Emma. Thank you for listening to us. And I hope you can find some time today to think maybe a little bit more about how to work a little bit less. So cheers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dallas.